holy war this afternoon. And we come to the paragraph where Beelzebub had ended his oration. And the paragraph begins with the words, "When Beelzebub had ended his oration, then Apollyon did begin." Now, we have had Beelzebub, now we're going to have Apollyon, and then later, of course, Diabolus will bring this matter to a conclusion. "When Diabolus had ended his oration, then Apollyon did begin. My opinion," said he, "concerning this matter is that we go on fair and softly, not doing things in a hurry." Now, you're going to find out later, that's not at all the view that Diabolus entertained. But this was supposed to be some wise counsel as to how they may continue to go about retaking man's soul. Remember now, that's what they're talking about. That's what all this context conversation is about. "Let our friends in man's soul go on still to pollute and defile it by seeking to draw it yet more into sin." And then Bunyan has this parenthetical, "For there is nothing like sin to devour man's soul." He says, "If this be done and it takes effect, man's soul of itself will leave off to watch, to petition, or anything else that should tend to her security and safety. For she will forget her Emmanuel, she will not desire his company, and can she be forgotten thus to live, her prince will not come to her in haste. Our trusty friend, Mr. Carnal Security, with one of his tricks, did drive him out of the town. And why may not Mr. Lord, my Lord Covetousness and my Lord Lasciviousness, why not, by what they do, keep him out of the town? And this I will tell you, not because you know it not, that two or three Diabolians, if entertained and countenanced by the town of Mansoul, will do more to the keeping of Emmanuel from them, and towards making the town of Mansoul your own, than can an army of a legion that should be sent out from us to withstand him." Now that sentence is a principle, is a profound statement that needs to be starred or marked or underlined or something in your book and in your heart. Two or three Diabolians entertained and countenanced by the town of Mansoul will do more to destroy her than a whole legion of armies sent out against her. We all, sadly, know that all too well by experience. Entertain one or two sins. Entertain, now I mean holding on, keeping, caressing one or two sins, knowing, and it will go a great ways to destroy man's soul and to keep Emmanuel away from the place. He says, "Let therefore this first project that our friends in man's soul have set on foot, let it be strongly and diligently carried on with all cunning and craft imaginable. Let them sin continually under one guise or another, more and other of their men to play with the people of man's soul. And then perhaps we shall not need to be at the charge of making a war upon them. Or if that must of necessity be done, yet the more sinful they are, the more unable to be sure they will be to resist us and then the more easily we shall overcome them. And besides, suppose, and that is the worst that can be supposed, that Emmanuel should come to them again, why may not the same means or the like drive him from them once more? Yea, why may he not, by his lapse into that sin again, be driven from them forever, for the sake of which he was at the first driven from them for a season? And if this happen, then away go with him his rams, his slings, his captains, his soldiers, and he leaveth man's soul naked and bare. Yea, will not this town, when she sees herself utterly forsaken of her prince, of her own accord, open her gates again unto you, and make of you in the days of old, as in the days of old? But this must be done by time. A few days will not effect this great work. So, Apollyon is proposing that they stick with the plan they already have operating, which is to send in disguise Diabolians, which will sort of covertly lead man's soul to more and more sin, which is going to leave them not only bankrupt themselves, but it's going to drive Emmanuel away and keep him away. Not only that, he will withdraw his forces from the town completely if they continue in sin. Berger said, apostasy is often a gradual affair, a sure poison, but slow. When the enemy has so far prevailed by temptation that sin has been entertained in the soul as lasciviousness, covetousness, then is the time to pour into the soul a crowd of distressing doubts respecting our own salvation. And this is the natural and usual consequence of sin indulged. When sin is indulged, Berger says, and we will see later in this story, that doubt, even doubting our own salvation, becomes the order of the day. It's natural, it's unavoidable. So soon as Apollyon had made an end of speaking, Diabolus began to blow out his own malice and plead his own cause. Now, so far there's been call for patience, for a working plan that will take time. Now, Diabolus speaks. My lords and powers of the cave, my true and trusty friends, I have with much impatience, as becomes me, given ear to your long and tedious orations. But my furious gorge and empty pouch so lusteth after a repossession of my famous town of Mansoul, that whatever comes out, I can wait no longer to see the events of lingering projects. I must, and that without further delay, seek by all means I can to fill my insatiable gulf with the soul and body of the town of Mansoul. Therefore, lend me your heart, your heads, your hearts, and your help. Now I'm going to recover my town of Mansoul. He's tired of listening to the talk. Not interested in the plans or projects. don't want to hear it. He wants it, and he wants it right now. Absolutely. Let come what may, let happen what will. I want it now. Our great commentator has this to say. And yet another thought occurs, suggested by the great Apollyon. To go fair and softly and allow the evil nature to work out its own results, making the soul more sinful and corrupt. A few traitors within the camp, enemies disguised as friends, yea, receiving substance and pay as servants, are 1,000 times more hurtful than an open armament or expedition from without. The sins that are prompted from within render the soul consciously responsible, and it blames itself, and oftentimes is seized by a spirit of despair and says, I will yet be more vile. This method would seem also to be the more natural outworking of the evil nature and better calculated to overwhelm the soul in condemnation than a more violent assault of Satan and his legion. For the more sinful a man becomes, the weaker he grows. Committed sin is one of the greatest allies of the wicked one. Well, that's a huge statement. Committed sin is one of the greatest allies of the wicked one. It weakens the spirit of resistance, offends the conscience, hurts the soul, and robs the man of his hope in the promises of God. The aim and design of Satan is to make the sinner so sinful as that God should finally and forever withdraw his presence, and therewith all the things that belong to God, his word, his ministers, holy thoughts, and virtues of the soul. This indeed would all be gone. But this would be a work of time. And meanwhile, his spirit of impatience will not permit the great Diabolus to wait. And here occurs a grand and eloquent description of that terrible wrath of the roaring lion, hungering and thirsting after souls. He cannot wait. He has hungered and thirsted long enough and can refrain no longer. My furious gorge, he said, an empty pouch, so lusteth after a repossession of my famous town of Mansoul, that whatever comes out, I can wait no longer. The word of Diabolus is omnipotent in hell. The word of Diabolus is omnipotent in hell, and accordingly, on this occasion, it is promptly obeyed. The meaning is that Satan's impetuous wrath, his hunger and thirst for souls, sometimes causes him to refuse more wily counsel that would be more adapted to the destruction of the soul. There are times, indeed, when Satan outwits himself by his own rapacity and eagerness, like the lion of the forest, which sometimes in a moment of rapacious hunger overleaps his prey. And so now, the more wily counsels are abandoned, and a fierce assault is decided on, by which it is designed to subjugate the soul, and to bring it finally and forever under the power of hell. So, there is a beautiful woodcut in our of Diabolus ranting in the presence of them all, and that's exactly what he is doing, ranting. He's angry, he's been impatient, he's tired of listening to all these counsels, and he wants to act now. I'm always amused with the prolific use of serpents in these woodcuts. Anytime they're depicting Satan or any of his characters or minions, there's a proliferation of serpents in those pictures. Bunyan goes on, when the lords and princes of the pit saw the flaming desire that was in Diabolus to devour the miserable town of man's soul, they left off to raise any more objections, but consented to lend him what strength they could. Though had Apollyon's advice been taken, they had far more fearfully distressed the town of Mansoul. But I say they were willing to lend him what strength they could, not knowing what need they might have of him when they should engage for themselves as he. Wherefore they failed to advising about the next thing propounded, namely, what soldiers they were, and how many, when with whom Diabolus should go against the town of Mansoul to take it. And after some debate, it was concluded, according as to the letter of the Diabolians had suggested, that none were more fit for that expedition than an army of terrible doubters. None more fit than an army of terrible doubters. I don't suppose I have to tell you man's soul is never more, especially a soul that has known the residency of Emmanuel, a soul that has ever once known what it was to have Emmanuel as her resident, that soul is never more defeated, never more in a dangerous place than when it is taken by doubt. They failed to advising about the next thing propounded, namely, what soldiers they were, and also how many, with whom Diabolus should go against the town of Mansoul to take it. And after some debate, it was concluded, according as in the letter of Diabolus had suggested, that none were more fit for that expedition than an army of terrible doubters. They are called terrible doubters in that sentence. Bunyan calls them sturdy doubters in the next sentence. They therefore conclude to send against man's soul an army of sturdy doubters. The number thought fit to be employed in that service was between 20,000 and 30,000. Wow. Once the heart starts doubting, it just starts doubting everything. Everything. 20,000 to 30,000. So then the result of that great council of those high and mighty lords was that Diabolus should even now, out of hand, beat up his drum for men in the land of doubting, which land lieth upon the confines of the place called Hellgate Hill, for men that might be employed by him against the miserable town of Mansoul. It was also concluded that these lords themselves should give him in the war, and that they would, to that end, head and manage his men. So they drew up a letter, and they sent back to the Diabolians that lurked in Mansoul and that waited for the back coming of Mr. Profane to signify to them into what method and forwardness they at present had put their design. An army of doubters, our commentator says. Here commences the inauguration of that terrible army of doubt, which continues to harass the soul more or less, even to the end. This is an interesting, a painfully interesting phase of the soul's off-checkered history. For now, the devices of Satan are designed against the few remaining hopes and joys of man's soul. A dark and terrible night of anguish is about, for a time at least, to settle upon the spirit of man whose spiritual history is here described. We must not omit to mention here that this phase of the allegory not only opens up the sequel of the Holy War, but also illustrates that arrow of Satan's quiver, which was ever the most powerful against Bunyan himself, the weapon of doubt. Some of us might be more exposed to the assault of pride. Others might yield more to the wanton and vain spirit. But Bunyan seems ever to have fallen most easily under the power of doubt and desperation. He has, therefore, very naturally thrown this part of his allegory in the direction of his own experience. And as he had done in the Pilgrim's Progress, so now he speaks of himself and of his own fierce struggles with the Wicked One. Thus, in the Pilgrim's Progress, we read of the Slough of Despond, of Doubting Castle, and Giant Despair. And even at the last, in the fords of the river, his doubts and fears got the better of his hopes and joys, and he had well nigh drowned him in their depths. So also in this, his Grace Abounding, which is his own personal biography, as you know, he tells the awful story of his oft-recurring seasons of doubt and dark despair. And so now, in the Holy War, he writes the allegory in the light of his own personal experience, and accordingly he lays stress on this particular weapon of the Wicked One as the chosen engine for the renewed assault upon the soul. Let us then, in anticipating the raising of this terrible army, contemplate the purport and meaning of this phase of the soul's experience. Of doubts in general, we may say, with Lord Bacon, suspicions are among thoughts as bats among birds. They come out in the twilight. Doubts arise in the dark seasons of the soul, and during the darkness they alarm and terrify the conscience. Doubt is the child of little knowledge. Therefore, let it no more. It is the twilight of the soul. Then let the sun arise, dispel the gloom. It sees through a glass darkly, not with open face. So open wide the door, and boldly confront the dark and lowering foe, and bid him be gone. Ignorance of God and of Christ and of the comforts of the Spirit is calculated to promote doubt. Knowledge of God and Christ and the Spirit dissipates doubt. During this dark season, the soul sees no light because it's shut up, and the windows of the soul are closed and barred against the entrance of light. These doubts are oftentimes like the ghosts we read of. They come out at midnight, but when they hear the cock crowing and catch the sharp, biting air of the morning, when honest folk go forth to labor, they're chased away to their hiding places. Doubt's the cloudland of Christians, the suburbs of the experience of many, only needing the sun to shine in its clear noonday power and glory to dissipate the abyss and mysteries of ignorance and doubt. Be bold to touch them with a realizing hand, and they're gone. That sounds like simple counsel, doesn't it? Sounds like easy counsel. But just because it sounds simplistic doesn't mean it's not so. It is so. Doubt is a land of darkness, so bring the light to it. Bring the light to it. Read the promises. Open the windows. Read the promises. The book's full of them. Would you dare to call God a liar? Do you dare to call God a liar? Do you dare to say that those promises are not true or that they're not meant for you? What an ungodly thing to do. Fling the windows open. Throw the light on it. All your doubt. You have no reason to doubt this God. He never lied. And he's not lying to you. Open the windows. A fully detailed account, he says, and description of this terrible army will be given by Bunyan in the subsequent pages. There we shall be able to read what his mastermind itself, so oft exercised by doubt, what it has to say to his fellow Christians respecting this formidable power of the evil one. Against Bunyan, the armory of hell contained no more potent weapon than this one, and with unsparing rigor was it used, making the servant of the Lord to feel how deeply the iron entered into his soul. From the deep and hungry gorge of hell, from the compassionless bowels of the pit, by the counsel of devils and doomed spirits, at the stern demand of the impatient and infuriate God of the abyss, with the resonant curse of hell as a blessing on the vast enterprise, and with the thousand acclamations of the damned, the decision is arrived at, that the messenger departs with the tidings thereof to the diabolians of man's soul. Doubt. And by the way, what is doubt but disbelieving God? Is that right? What is doubt but disbelieving God? What is doubt but not believing God? When you read in his word what he says, and I realize that some in their nature have a greater propensity to darkness of the soul, to a clouded sky, to despair and doubt and depression. Some are naturally bent in that direction. I understand that. But I also understand that our commentator is not wrong. Doubt is the business of darkness. And the answer to it is light. Bring the light to it. And it cannot stay. It will flee away. It cannot stay. Again, I know that sounds simplistic, and some would say, well, that's just great, but it doesn't work. It does work. Because if you read Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, what is it that always delivered him? Going back to the scroll, to the key, going back to light, would fling open the doors of doubting castle. Light is the answer. Do we have any questions or discussion? We stopped actually in our reading back here where the contents, we will take up next time the contents of this letter sent back to man's soul to the diabolians who lurked in man's soul by Mr. Profane. Sorry, looking for his name. Mr. Profane carries the letter back to man's soul. And we'll take up that letter and its contents later. It's quite lengthy. So do we have any comments, questions, or enlargements on this subject? It is, of course, there is no disguising the fact that the particular Bunyan is writing this allegory. It's his allegory. He can write it whatever way he sees fit. He can introduce whatever characters and give them whatever weight he wants them to have. And Bunyan, and I agree with the commentator, Bunyan is writing here from his own experience. And this is the one evil, this is the one enemy which plagued his soul the greatest, brought him the greatest discomfort to the very end. And so it is to this that he focuses in this section of his allegory. Any questions, comments, additions?